Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. In 1923, Photoplay, a trailblazing American film fan magazine, crowned June Mathis, quote, the most powerful woman in the motion picture industry, end quote. Yet her name and legacy remain largely forgotten, overshadowed by the era that she dominated, Hollywood silent film golden age. At just 35, Mathis shattered glass ceilings as the first female executive at Metro MGM, commanding the highest salary of any executive in Hollywood. She was the visionary who discovered Rudolph Valentino, launching him to stardom. In June Mathis, The Rise and Fall of a Silent Film Visionary, my guest, Arthur Thomas J. Slater, delivers a long overdue tribute to her extraordinary life and impact. It's published by University Press of Kentucky, and this biography is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ira. Nice to be here.
Same here. Well, she had quite the career as a screenwriter and producer, but before we get into her, how about you? What's your background and why you decided to write about someone who is not known as well as other people?
Okay, yeah. Well, it all started back in 1984. I was a graduate student at Oklahoma State, working on my doctorate with film professors, Peter C. Rollins and Leonard Leff. And Dr. Rollins was my mentor. And at one point, he gave me the opportunity to write some entries for the Gale Publishing Company. And they published a series of reference books about authors. And they were going to do one on screenwriters. And, you know, so I picked out June Mathis's name and found out something about her. And at that point, you know, I was wondering what it meant to have influence during the silent era, you know, and how she had obtained it and what was she trying to accomplish. You know, what kind of things did she want to get onto the screen, and how successful was she, and what kind of opposition did she face?
But what got you to pick her specific name?
I was just looking over a series of women screenwriters. I thought, you know, I'll just take that approach, mm-hmm. you know. And of the ones I chose, she was the most interesting. And the more I looked into her, you know, as I continued researching over the years, the more fascinating she became, you know. And then a number of materials, you know, turned up, and I just was able to keep digging.
Oh, wait, that's kind of general. Let's go back to that a second. You say a number of materials showed up or turned up. It doesn't just turn up. So you're obviously looking for stuff. Word must have gotten out that you were going to be writing a book about her.
Right. Yeah.
That'd be a fair way to figure out how all this material just showed up.
Right. Yeah. I would say so. Yeah. You know, and I was doing some other publishing in the meantime, you know, and, you know, I don't know how I found out about the archives at USC, but I got some grant money from my school, Indiana U of Pennsylvania, went out there and found that they had a number of her scripts and folders of papers and telegrams, for example, on Ben-Hur and her work on the Ben-Hur production, and things on other productions of hers like that. They had the Colleen Moore scrapbooks, you know, which somebody kept for Colleen Moore, I guess, you know, and anything that her name was in, they clipped it out and put it in there. So there was a lot of Mathis in there.
Were you surprised when they approached you that you were interested in that subject, and were they very helpful there? Usually research librarians are very helpful.
Oh, absolutely. Ned Comstock, I think so many, film researchers over the years at the USC Film and Television Study Center in the library there. Ned was essential for a lot of writers and scholars to know. He just did great work and said, "What do you need?" And I'll find it, and found things that you didn't even know existed. He was great.
Now that's a it's good when you got a good reference librarian or library as well that can help you out in your research. How long were you out there?
I made like about three trips out there, I think around 94, and then a couple of times after that,
How does that
and I
work when you get out there, though? How does that work in terms of, clearly they can provide materials to you, but they also don't want you removing them from the library. Are you able
All
to
right.
keep copies of diary entries and other papers?
Right. Well, at first, when the first time when I went out there and I didn't have a laptop, I had to take notes in pencil, and
Hey.
and there was a huge amount of stuff, more than I realized, so I'm taking, I still got these, cards, index cards on which I have all my notes, and they're pretty elliptical, but they're still there, and
Couldn't
that
they
got me
make
stuck.
you when they would be allow you to make a copy on a copy machine? Or no, that's not allowed, or
There was too much, and
okay.
for a lot of that, the paper is very fragile, so
Good
like
point.
scripts and so forth.
Sure. Did you ever
So
find out how they got hold of all of this for their archives at USC? In other words, was it a studio that went through several ownership changes because it's from the silent movie era? How did they end up getting this material? Or was it donated by the family? Or how did you ever find out?
No, I think these would probably just fall into the hands of various collectors, and they would end up as, the so-and-so collection,
Well, Tom, I think what you need to do is take a flight out immediately to LA and find out
I think
how we
so.
got that. I think that
Gotta
might
nail
work.
this down.
Yeah, please. It's very important. So, were you surprised at how much June accomplished? Again, it's June Mathis, The Rise and Fall of a Silent Film Visionary. And it's available, as I mentioned, in University of Press of Kentucky. Were you surprised at the wealth of material and what she accomplished in her career?
Like I said, the amount of material just kept growing over the years, and I just kept finding things almost up to when I finally got the final draft finish, so that was great. I don't know. I'm sure there are other writers like Frances Marion, and Lois Weber on whom this amount of material exists. But she did so much writing, and as I went through her material and went through like newspaper items, I kept finding about how much she worked. I mean, it just seems constant that she worked, that she was always writing, sometimes working on three or four, screenplays at a time. And one of her colleagues says she's up till 2 or 3 in the morning. She was also trying to do some playwriting in the teens, and various newspaper items that would say, she's not only writing screenplays, she is going out to the sets and watching the productions and making comments to the actors and editing. And she would be doing some comments on costumes and selecting directors for various productions. It had to be like nonstop, so it's almost no surprise that she died at the age of 40.
Yeah, she worked herself to death in a way.
She pretty much did.
That period of time, we always think, when I say we, in general, the public thinks that women were not involved in the film industry until maybe the late 50s, early 60s, into the 70s, whatever. But yet here you have proof that there were female successful movie, not only producers and directors, but executives from that period.
Right, absolutely. And the fact that we didn't know isn't accidental. You know, they were pretty much just dropped, you know, from film history.
But why, though? What would be the reason to drop them from film history?
I think it was because the field was male-dominated, you know, and that their work, for some reason, would have been considered not quite as important or not quite as sophisticated, you know. And then again, you know, there were several women directors in the teens. By the 20s, they weren't having as much opportunity. So when you have something like the auteur theory, people look at like Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse and say, well, that's a Rex Ingram film. You know, they look at Blood and Sand and say, that's a Fred Niblo film, you know, probably not noticing that, you know, both were written by June Mathis, and no one's looking at the scripts, you know, to define, okay, you know, what were her, you know, proclivities, what were her techniques, you know, that she would use, some of her themes, you know, and so that gets all pushed to the side, you know, and even in like 1932, someone who was as was friendly to her as St. John's, you know, what's her first name? she wrote several books about Hollywood gossip and so forth. And she said in 1932, well, there's only been three, you know, women who have directed, you know, and that's, you know, clearly Roger St. John, clearly she knew, you know, better than that. And yet she didn't, you know, she didn't state that, you know. So they were simply, you know, dropped, you know, from film history. And, you know, you go through the kind of the birth and the growth of film studies in the 1960s, 70s, and so forth, mm-hmm. you know, and it's all men who are focused on, you know.
Well, you did have people like Ida Lupino who directed.
Yeah. Yeah. And she doesn't get mentioned much until like the 80s, 90s. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Horsley Arzner.
Yeah. Cause she was married to Howard Duff, and they both were known as actors, but she did a lot of directing. And
absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Were you surprised too when you started to put it all together? Were you able to talk to any, obviously there were no contemporaries that you could talk to her, but were there, for example, granddaughters or great granddaughters or great nieces or great nephews that you were able to get hold of?
Absolutely. Yeah. I was, you know, really fortunate in that. With all the other sources, it would have been hard for this to come together if I hadn't gotten to know Diane Mathis Madsen, her grandniece. Diane provided me with letters that June wrote from Italy and from when she was coming back after the production of Ben-Hur, writing to her family, writing to her fiance, personal notes that she was writing from in the hospital. A lot of the photos, most of the photos in the book, including the one on the cover, are from Diane's collection. And, Jim Craig had put me in touch with her, and so that was fantastic. And
well, you say Jim Craig, so let's identify who Jim Craig is.
Oh, he's just private film, silent film enthusiast, and especially with Valentino has you know, a lot of knowledge and artifacts and so forth relating to Valentino. So
were you able in your research to see whether Valentino ever publicly acknowledged June Mathis?
Oh, constantly. He always did. Yeah. Yeah. He always said, you know, I owe everything to her, you know.
Wouldn't that, as a result of that, though, wouldn't that come out because Rudolph Valentino even today is known? And mm-hmm. so if he was publicly acknowledging her
mm-hmm.
way back then, wouldn't she then still be publicly known because he was acknowledging her? If that makes sense.
Yeah, you might think so. But it doesn't seem to have been the case. No.
Interesting. Do you think it's ironic that later on, and this is obviously after the silent era, but two of the major film columnists or Hollywood columnists were female.
Yeah.
And male. Hedda Hopper.
Luella Parsons.
And Luella Parsons. Hedda Hopper.
Right. Yeah. And Adela Rogers St. John's. That was the name I was trying to think of. So
it's funny because when you said that, I was in my mind trying to remember the first part, Adela. I couldn't get it out of my head. So I literally thinking I was wrong, but that's correct. Yeah. Adela Rogers St. John.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. You know, I mean, with Valentino, so much was focused on the scandal with his marriage first, you know, and then his second marriage came to Natasha Rambova, and the California a DA out there decided that he had married too soon after his first divorce, and he was arrested on bigamy. And it was June Mathis who came to the prison, you know, and helped bail him out. You know, famous players Lasky, the studio he was with at the time, did nothing for him, you know. And she would visit him on the set, like of The Son of the Sheik, where he was already ailing and, you know, trying to encourage him, take it easy, you know.
Well, so Tom, was that a different period of Hollywood time in the sense that we know of the big Hollywood movie studio system and the fact that if some star got into trouble, the studio would send over their head of security to bail the guy out and make it very quiet. So this was a case where Rudolph Valentino wasn't helped by the studio because it was in a different era, I guess.
Right. Yeah. It seemed to have something to do with, you know, they weren't going to pay him anymore. And a number of the studio heads, even Richard Roland, who was at Metro, for whom he'd made, you know, Four Horsemen, they were saying, well, the guy's just a flash in the pan. You know, he's not going to last very long. So don't worry about it, you know. And no one was wanting to pay him more. And when he got into trouble, the studio wasn't going to stick out their necks to try to help him.
When you were researching June, and there's so much to pick from, obviously, but was there one thing that jumped out at you that was surprising?
That was surprising.
In other words, something you didn't know on your initial decision to do some research on her and then to write a book about her. Again, the book is June Mathis, The Rise and Fall of a Silent Film Visionary. Was there one or maybe two things that you came across or through talking with someone verbally? Well, that's how you talk with people. But in other words, when you're talking with someone, that all of a sudden you discover something that, oh, there's an epiphany or eureka. I have found something that nobody else knows, or I didn't know.
Well, what I found was, you know, through studying her scripts and through studying, you know, the extant films that were made from her scripts, you know, that she had her own perspective, okay? That she had a set of ideas that she wanted to present through the films. You know, and she does this over and over, you know, at least starting in 1917 with the the Legion of Death, the World War One film, and with her films with Nazimova shortly after that, like Eye for Eye and The Red Lantern. She starts with this specific idea of what women have to offer. She defines them as having an essentially spiritual nature, that is necessary, in this world where, war and violence and, commercialism and greed, have created such an upheaval, such a loss of order and values, it seems, that women were necessary for providing a kind of spiritual leadership,
Yeah, perhaps a balance to what's out there.
Balance, absolutely. Well. Yeah. Uh-huh. And there's this theme all the way through her work that hadn't been noticed, And I think that's important when, when you look at the 20s, and it's celebrated so much as an era of masculinity, the jazz age and all that, this very important theme tends to get lost, but it was there. It has continued, and it was there not just in the major films that she worked on, like, Four Horsemen and Greed and Blood and Sand, but also in some of the minor films that have been forgotten, but that often were very good, like The Willow Tree in 1920, or The Idle Rich, from the same year. So those kinds of things, they were great. And then after 1920, she starts getting a lot more feedback as the production system changes, and the financial interests from New York and start taking over, and it becomes much more of an organized business interest, rather than the people right at the studio making the decisions, So,
yeah, it did change. Did she, you know, in the title of your book, there's the rise and there's the fall.
Yeah.
In the fall part, did she, when she left the industry, was she bitter?
She never left the industry. She died.
Well, that's true. But left the internet. Let me rephrase that, Your Honor. When she became freelance.
Yeah.
Before, she was working as both an executive, she was a writer, she did all these things. And then she ended up becoming a freelancer because of the changing nature of the industry.
Yeah.
She bitter at that point.
It's hard to say. I couldn't get enough material about her feelings, her personal response to all that. There were some times, like, she would say, I know, in 1926, she does an article, and she's, interviewed, and she says, I know that as a screenwriter, I have to work just as hard today to get my material onto the screen as when I first started, And I imagine that she did have certainly some bitterness. I think that, after she left Metro in 1922, very early that year, she never had the same kind of creative freedom. Part of that was her fault, that she took on way too much. She went to Goldwyn and they said, can you make Ben-Hur for us? And she said, fine. And she works on that for 6 months, and then they say, "Well, we really need someone to just run the studio. Can you do that?" And she said, "Fine." And for all of the next year, she does nothing on Ben-Hur, and people are saying, "When's this gonna get made?"
She's got her hands in too many pots.
Too many, too much.
It's amazing. We only have a minute or so left, but I wanted to get from what you want people, readers, to take from the book, the most important element that you want, or maybe there's more than one, but what do you want readers
Oh,
to take
more than
from your book?
I want them to enjoy it, and I want them to see that, she had a lot to contribute. It wasn't just that she had a few hits and that she discovered Valentino, but she had a lot to contribute, through her artistry. She knew the film business, she knew filmmaking, and there were many women like her, at the same time, which I try to suggest as well, this try to give more of a picture of the whole era there. And I hope people will perhaps realize that and say, "Oh, there's more to look at there than I realized."
Last question. Do you think that your book will bring her more recognition in the sense of some, not necessarily the Motion Picture Academy, but some more recognition of her contributions to the film industry?
I think that depends on if, writers like, for newspapers, magazines, podcasts, pick up on this, film scholars pick up on this, students now, keep that focus, and just explore, there's so much more to explore. I would be really glad to see more of that going on.
Well, that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been Thomas J. Slater. He's author of June Mathis, The Rise and Fall of a Silent Film Visionary. It's published by University Press of Kentucky. It's available on Amazon, Barnes and Noble, and all the usual places. And Tom, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks very much, Ira. It was great.
Same here. And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.